LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Gary Lachman, who joins us to discuss his memoir, Touched by the Presence, From Blondie's Bowery and Rock and Roll to Magic and the Occult. The book traces Gary's journey from founding member of Blondie to writer on consciousness and the esoteric tradition. He explores his involvement in Gurdjieff's Fourth Way, Crowley's Thelema, and his relationship with author Colin Wilson. He also shares how an early love of comics, science fiction, and fantasy led him to the esoteric tradition. From his rock and roll days, he recalls encounters with, among others, the Ramones, New York Dolls, Patti Smith, the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, and Iggy Pop. Excursions to Stonehenge, Avebury, and Glastonbury in search of ley lines, and pilgrimage to Colin Wilson's home in Cornwall are just a few of the many highlights of this introspective, humorous account of a nascent writer's struggle from the music business to self-discovery and beyond. Hello and welcome, Gary, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thank you for inviting me once again to be on the show, Greg.
I don't know how many years we've been speaking on and off, Gary, but it's been many, and many of your books that we've discussed in the past and subjects that we're both very interested in. Listeners can find all of those linked on the website page for this talk. Today we're going to be discussing your recently released or just about to be released autobiography / memoir. That's called Touched by the Presence, From Blondie's Bowery and Rock and Roll to Magic and the Occult. Before we jump into that, for listeners who are not familiar with your work, just give us a little potted bio.
Yeah, I'm a writer on subjects dealing with consciousness and esotericism, Western esoteric tradition and culture. I had an earlier career as a musician in the late 1970s into the early 80s, playing with a few bands, one of whom, Blondie, went on to become quite famous. And this new book, Blondie's even in the subtitle, Blondie's Bowery. This is where I was living 50 years ago, around this time, actually, on this part of New York that became famous because of this rock club CBGB, out of which Blondie and the Ramones and many other bands emerged. So, yeah, the book is that story. That's basically what we'll be talking about.
Well, if you go back to the start, of course, best place to begin, really. I identified with so many of your stories and your anecdotes and, you know, your recollections in this book, because, you know, we've got a lot of things in common. Maybe that's why I was sort of subconsciously drawn to your work in the first place. But I loved your reminiscence about your childhood days and, you know, how into books you were in the early stages, and, you know, and movies and TV shows and comics and things, because I had a very similar kind of trajectory. I mean, I guess a lot of kids do, whatever part of the world they're in, particularly if they're in the West, mostly boys, girls to a lesser extent. But you seem to have had a similar experience to the one that I had, in the sense that exploring the books and movies and TV shows, and it was opening up other vistas beyond, you know, the room that we were in, our childhood bedroom, or the world outside the window, you know, the beyond the mundane. It was kind of like the imagination, even fantastic, you know, worlds that maybe don't even exist. It was simply that idea planted in your mind that the world and reality is so much bigger than is presented to us, but, you know, for the most part, and that, you know, imagination is such a powerful tool. And it's not just about creating fiction, that, you know, imagination can play a role in, you know, shaping your life and shaping the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you say back to beginnings, I mean, I do trace my interests in the sort of thing I subsequently came to write about, back to when I was quite young and reading comic books. So this would be in the early 1960s. I was born 1955, Christmas Eve, so at the end of 1955, so say practically beginning of 56. And in terms of comic books, that time, then 57, I think, is really the year, 57, 58, subsequently came to be known as the Silver Age of comics. And it was a period of revival of a lot of the comic superhero characters from the 1940s. A lot of them had gone into a slump. I mean, even comics like Batman were almost threatened with going out of print and stopping publication. The post-World War II, they weren't as popular as they had been previous to that. So I first became aware of comic books, say, probably by the time I was about five. And I tell the story in the book where there was one series, The Legion of Superheroes, and these were teenagers from different planets or from the future that had superpowers, kind of like predating the X-Men. One of them was a character named Cosmic Boy, and his power was magnetism. And I didn't understand why he wasn't called Magnetic Boy, or Magnet Boy, or as Magneto would be called in the X-Men, or something like that. So I remember asking my sister what cosmic meant, and she didn't know. So she would have been about, yeah, she's 4 years older than me. So if I was five, she was about nine or something like that. And I asked my mother, and she didn't know. So you could say, my life subsequent to that was trying to find out what, cosmic meant. And but as you say, I mean, there you go. I'm growing up in a small, flat in what's practically a suburb of Manhattan, but it's in a different state. It's in New Jersey. It's across the Hudson, but it was pretty much a suburb of it may as well have been another borough of New York. How close we were, and as you say, just growing up in this everyday world, but suddenly I'm introduced to other planets in the future, and people with these remarkable powers, and time travel, and aliens, and so many different things. And I just felt, I don't know what's the I just felt some kind of, it's what I call nostalgia for a place I've never been, kind of. And you can get highbrow about it, and I do talk about this a bit in the book, where there's a German word, Sehnsucht, and it's usually translated as an unfulfillable longing, but there's a kind of yearning for something more, than the everyday. And I was introduced to that at a very young age through comic books, and had profound transformative power on me.
It's interesting. The next, excuse me, the next phrase in my notes is quote, nostalgia for a place I've never been, which I was going to come to because I identified with that because I found with, I was particularly into science fiction and science fantasy, not so much horror, though I did like it, but I felt it were the best that the writers I enjoyed most, like Michael Moorcock, for example, that I really could feel the places and the characters and the places he described. And I felt that I had been to these places to some extent, even just as an observer, not a participant. You know, it was very, very powerful effect. And even then, going out into the ordinary world of like school and everything that everyday life consisted of, I felt just a little bit uplifted. I felt that I kind of almost like I knew something that other people didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly what you mean. And there's a kind of I mean, it still happens now, and I am enjoying a book I'm reading, and you have that magical feeling of sinking in, getting into, we say getting into it, and literally it's a metaphor, but and you're in a different dimension there. And sometimes you can get into it so much. I mean, where I live, like my neighbor upstairs, I could be reading or something and drop something on his floor, and then I almost have a cardiac because it's something like, oh, I'm reminded of this other world. But no, that was certainly, and I wasn't alone. And I think one thing though, talking about like maybe different generations, I do think my generation was still one where people were reading, and it was like a way. And not that people don't read now, they do, but it's not quite the same thing. I mean, it's I know it's easy. I'm older, it's easy for me to say, oh well, it used to be better back then. Not so much better, but I do remember, as I say, this is a book about how books have affected me and influenced me. And there was and the wonderful thing about paperbacks, the old paperbacks, the old pocketbook, paperbacks that you could put literally in your back pocket. And so many sci-fi and fantasy and whatever books I would get, you would walk around with them, and that was the other thing, something you could just pull out and sit down and read and wherever you were. And no, they were certainly an escape for me. I mean, my family weren't readers. I came from a what they call a blue collar family in the States, so it would be working class labor. Democrats, blue collar Democrats, and both my parents, they came from what subsequently called like the greatest generation, and they both left high school before finishing it because they had to work and all of that. So it was a big deal for myself and my sister, to actually for them finish high school and then go on to college and all that sort of thing. That was something they didn't do, but they weren't readers in this way, and I must have seemed strange to them. I can't place it anywhere in my immediate family that anyone else, like cousins or uncles or anything like that, there really wasn't anything. So I wonder, where did this gene come from? Some 60% of my genes, according to this DNA test did come from Eastern Europe. So I'm wondering some Kabbalist out
Could
that way.
be, could be. I mean, I'm adopted, so my family weren't readers either, other than, magazines and newspapers. Nothing wrong with that. But because I've read my fair share of magazines, worked in magazines for like 30 years anyway. But and I know you've, again, another thing we have in common, you writing articles and reviews, and that was my stock in trade for a long time. So being adopted, I have no connection with my natural parents that I know of. So again, I could have been come from a bookish genes, as it were. First comic I ever got was 2000 AD, the first issue of that, which came out in, I don't know, was it 1976 or something like that? But I was drawn to that because there was a, I don't know if you've ever read 2000 AD, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but
Subsequent to moving here and knowing about it, but it wasn't something that I was a reader of.
of course, yeah, I seem to forget it's British. The assumption was that any
I'm
good
from the States, I grew up in the States, so it's different. So,
any good comic book was meant to be American, you see, so I forget the 2000 AD is not American. So but they I was heavily into dinosaurs, like, again, like a lot of young boys are, and there was a strip, not comic, a strip in 2000 AD called Flesh, which was essentially about time traveling humans going back to the prehistoric era and harvesting dinosaurs for meat. And
Oh my gosh.
that's what hooked me in. But of course, 2000 AD was so much more about, the future and science fiction. Judge Dredd is probably the most famous to come from that. Again, that did the same thing for me. I would have been age 7 then, was just to throw up on this, before I'd started reading books, really, to throw up on all these other worlds, these possible places that, as I don't know how you were as a child, but obviously, other than reading your book, but I was very much, and I would spend even a summer's day inside and read a book, rather than be outside playing football or whatever, which I wasn't interested in. So for me, there was nothing better than traveling to the Jurassic period or whatever, or traveling to, another planet while in my bedroom reading this book. That was kind of, for me, was that was a journey that I wanted. That was unusual, even amongst my peers as well. You got called a geek or whatever, if you were doing that sort of thing. But
Well, I mean, I had similar experience. I mean, I have a footnote, I think, or in the book where I wasn't sporty. My father, he had several jobs, and one of them in the summertime, he was a umpire at softball games. And he would bring me along and, want me to get into the game, but I would always sneak a comic or a book with me and walk away. And then he would see me sitting someplace reading, saying, "What? Put that down. Watch the game," and stuff like that. So, yeah, no, I mean, it was certainly something that was, I felt more at home in that world than in the everyday world. And but also, I mean, the things from comics, I'm trying to how it actually transitioned, I guess is the word, or moved from comics into getting sci-fi paperbacks and all that. Although, I mean, it wasn't one thing to the other. I added to those, and it must have been the illustrations, the covers. This one thing I do write about in the book is this it was a company in the States called Ace Paperbacks, and they actually became they were actually instrumental in the Tolkien Lord of the Rings becoming the success it was back in the 60s, and then it continues to be today. But because Ace put out a unauthorized edition of the Lord of the Rings, because Tolkien's publisher failed to establish copyright in the States for some reason, and
Oh dear.
it became, strangely, it became a hit on the campuses in the 1960s, and along with like Kerouac and J.D. Salinger and Kurt Vonnegut and other, these were like campus, best-selling, books. And I remember the first place I heard about Tolkien was in Marvel Comics, because they Frodo lives. They would somehow have, turn up in some panel somewhere or something like that. And but I remember seeing, just getting back to these paperbacks, they seeing these covers of the Edgar Rice Burroughs books, the Tarzan books, or the John Carter of Mars, or Carson of Venus, and Pellucidar, and other fantastic adventures, and this artist Frank Frazetta. And I don't know, there was just something about it that just grabbed me. And I remember just collecting these. There was well, we used to call them a candy store in the States, or a drugstore. And used to have an old fountain. You could sit down and have a soda or something like that. But they had this paperback rack, and I think they must have had the stuff there for ages. And I would just go and rifle through all these and find these fantastic Frank Frazetta covers of these Burroughs books. And then from that, knowing Frazetta's work, that's when I saw Conan stories. I was complete devotee of the Robert E. Howard Conan stories. I think they started coming out in paperback in '66, so I would have been about 10, and I just started getting into them. And again, they had these Frank Frazetta covers, but he always managed to put in some scantily clad, very voluptuous woman.
Yes.
At the same time that Conan was battling off some huge dragon or whatever it is, kind of thing. And that was sort of my, introduction, adolescent introduction to sort of erotica. It sort of, gave me high expectations
Yeah. Well, I mean,
women I would meet later on in life. But yeah.
me spending like more than half my life so far in hard rock and heavy metal, the Frank Frazetta things were hanging like, hang on, this is a heavy metal album cover, basically.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it was Michael Moorcock, who I mentioned earlier. I came to some of those authors you mentioned later, but it was Moorcock that I was drawn into first in that kind of world, the sort of sword and sorcery and time travel and magic. And it was the covers on the paperbacks, these quite compact paperbacks, as you mentioned, compared to a lot of the books that get written today. I think books were smaller in the past, shorter, physically.
I was saying the whole idea is called a pocketbook. You could literally put it in your back pocket.
And it was the covers that drew me in, first of all, and a lot of which subsequently ended up being used on heavy metal albums, actually.
Oh yeah,
The
yeah, yeah.
artist in question in this case was Michael Whelan. And he did a lot of covers for, well, hundreds of books, but Michael Moorcock in particular. And it was when I got started down that route, again, I mentioned earlier about being transported at the same, to some other time, some other place. And it was reading fantasy like that in conjunction with things that I stumbled upon in the the bin in the local library where they were, thinning out their books to make way for new ones. And I found these books by Eric von Daniken, notorious, famous. But even if he's been discredited and debunked to a great extent, the point was that Moorcock and others like him were taking me to these other worlds and other times, other places. Von Daniken opened up another avenue in life, which is very important to me, which is like, is the story of the human of human history, particularly in prehistory, are we really being presented with the true story of human
No,
life on this planet?
it's
And that opened up a huge vista.
No, it's funny you mentioned that because I've been indulging on YouTube and watching this old series in the States from the 70s, In Search Of, with Leonard Nimoy, who's Mr.
Oh yes, I
Spock.
remember that.
I mean, and they're actually, they're very good. They're short. They're only about like 20, 22, 23 minutes. In Search of Bigfoot, In Search of Loch Ness Monster, and In Search of Ancient Astronauts, and they're so I myself, I remember reading this was later. This would have been when I got interested in sort of occult or whatever you want to call it, alternative sort of stuff. And after I saw it, playing Blondie in 75 and all that. But no, I mean, it's the kind of thing, it opens you up, so you and you can subsequently see, oh yeah, well, it's full of, what do you want to say? The book itself is, has a lot of mistakes. Just like there's another book I was talking about on an interview I did, but I just posted it recently, about the occult 60s and the Morney and the Magicians, which is one of these, as a friend said to me, it's a crap book that changes your life. I mean, it's not a very good book in the sense there's a lot of mistakes in it, but it's the kind of book that if you read it at the right time, you'd be thinking, oh wow, what's that? Oh my God. So I mean that again was one of those that I read, say like 1975, when I started getting interested in magic and the occult and all that weird kind of woo-woo, kind of whatever you want to call it. But no, I mean getting back, I mean Moorcock, I certainly read the Elric, and Dorian Hawkmoore, because that was the Sword and Sorcery, so that was contemporary. So you had Robert E. Howard, and then there was like Lynn Carter, who's another American, and another artist at the time, this guy named Jeff Jones. Yeah, there was he did not quite like Frazetta, but not too far from that. And then the Conan comic book with Barry Smith. Again, this is in America. So Barry Smith was this wonderful graphic artist, and he did a Conan comic in the 70s, that was very beautifully put together and all that. So I mean all of that sort of stuff. And then I mean the early introduction to me was saying like was all like Superman, Batman, The Flash, and then I discovered Marvel comics, which were very, very different because they took place in New York. It wasn't in mythical cities like Metropolis or Gotham or Central City. There's always some place that where might that be? It's sort of like New York was both Gotham and Metropolis. No, they took place in New York, and so the Fantastic Four had this skyscraper in the Baxter Building in New York, and then everybody else was in New York, the Spider-Man, the Avengers, so they'd be like popping up, little cameo appearances. And as I said already, I first heard about Lord of the Rings and Marvel, they Frodo lives or something like that, and it's like, what's all that about? So there would be contemporary references, and so that was very, very different to what the DC, again, this is in the States, so the Superman, Batman, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, again, that was a whole other, what do you want to call it, kind of encounter that helped shape, my identity, like as it was doing for, thousands or millions of other kids out
Yeah,
there.
of course, yeah, but
And then from that, so I was talking Robert E. Howard, the Conan stories, and then I learned about Weird Tales. And then, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is that, I mean, I'm not an academic historian, but I do, I do write historical books. I write books about, people in the past or, historical, sort of trends or movements, or history of this or that. But I think I became interested in that thing from comic books and from learning about the pulp magazines from the 20s and 30s into the 40s. And there was just something about that. I guess today this might be called hauntology. I don't know for sure because it's the recent past. So, but I mean, this is one of the things I wrote about in my first book, Turn If You Mind, which is about the occult influence on the 1960s, how a lot of the popular culture, at least for myself growing up in the States in the 60s, was popular culture of the 40s or the 30s or 40s. So, I remember watching W.C. Fields movies or the Marx Brothers on television, and then the hippies would pick that up. And you go to see, the college I went to, for a year before dropping out, you go to see like two Marx Brothers movies, and the room is just full of marijuana smoke and everything. So it was like, there's the wonderful early 70s when I was growing up was like that. But that was the other thing too. So getting into the weird tales, so it's interested in history and then broader, and then like Lovecraft was very strange. It wasn't the same thing as the sword and sorcery stuff. There wasn't the sex for one thing. It was sexless. And it had this strange kind of character to it where it wasn't adventure in the same way. And but I again I do think it somehow the best of weird fiction does approach what Edmund Burke, the British philosopher, called the sublime, which is not, it's not beautiful in the kind of canonical ideas of beauty, going back to classical beauty and all that. It has a power that's actually can be kind of upsetting and disturbing. There's something about that in the sort of the Lovecraftian setting of this ho the horror isn't, I mean, it's always monsters, but in the end, the horror isn't so much something that's going to rip your head off and eat you, which is just terror. It's this cosmic kind of horror in the sense that the universe is much bigger and inhuman than we would want to recognize.
Yeah,
And in
it's
a
a
way, and I was going to say, in a way, that kind of shadowed what I would get from when I started reading existentialism and Sartre and things like that.
yeah, I was just going to say it's existential, it's epistemological dimensions to it. What you mentioned in Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, just to backtrack slightly, I had an equivalent of that, which was Arthur C. Clarke and his TV series. He did three actually that I watched when they were broadcast. First one was Arthur C. Clarke's what's World of Strange Powers is the second one. I think Strange World might be the first one, but you can easily find details online. And they were quite, he was a popular science fiction author, but also wrote about a lot about hard science himself. And these TV series were along the lines of Nimoy's thing of, like the paranormal and supernatural and what have you. But that set me on a course for sure. We mentioned Colin Wilson at the top of the hour and you getting into the occult. I think from combination of a couple of things in terms of interest in the occult, I guess for me growing up listening to Black Sabbath, for example, and they're thinking, singing about occult themes, however loosely grounded in any type of like, research or reality. Now that drew me to things like Dennis Wheatley, and his occult novels, again, partly because of the covers and stuff. So, but all of that led me to the next town along from ours, because we didn't have a secondhand bookshop in our town. It was quite small. But there was a covered market. Probably the sort of thing you'd find in San Francisco, actually thinking about it, quite bohemian, lots of stalls, like head shops, as you call them, and secondhand books and groovy clothes and all the rest of it. But there was this one bookshop that I went into and I started to find books with these racy covers, and also the Dennis Wheatley stuff. And I got struck up. I would have been just like 14, 15 at the time, if that. And I struck up a sort of friendship with the guy. Sort of like he looked like an sort of ex-hippie casualty of the 60s who ran the place, and he started to put books aside for me and when he started to learn about my interests, and I'd come over a couple of times a month. One of the things I found in there that didn't have a striking cover at all, it just had occult written across it in an abstract design by this guy called Colin Wilson. So I got that, and I know that was very important for you as well. I mean, much, much more important in your life story. But that was another gateway thing for me in a major way, because I know he's been criticized for it, but Wilson was so eclectic, so broad ranging, so readable. He for me, he was a dot connector.
No, I mean, he was like H.G. Wells. He wrote, I once asked him, do you plan to outwrite H.G. Wells? And he laughed. It just, he's one of the, he said he writes like the dog scratches fleas. He had to write. So I think in one sense, yes, some people say he wrote too much, but if you're an avid reader of him, then no. I wish there were he was around and had written a few more books, because I've had to tell myself that I can't reread his books again for another like 3 years or something. But no, I mean, yeah, his book, The Occult, that was the one that really changed my life, as they say. That came across that when I was first playing in Blondie in 1975. Yeah, I said 50 years ago. Would have been the summer of 75. So I would have been re now I would have read that and also been introduced to Aleister Crowley, not personally, but his work, by this fellow, this wild gay biker artist who had the lease, insofar as there was one, on this building where I lived with Debbie, Harry, and Christine. We had a floor on a three-story building, Clement and Jimmy would come, to rehearse and hang out on the weekend. But I was living there with them, and yeah, this fellow, he was like very much into the Hells Angels, but very much into Aleister Crowley as well. And he had a deck, the Thoth Tarot deck, and he would do these tarot readings from that, and then he would read aloud from Diary of a Drug Fiend. And I had no interest in that sort of stuff aside from, I said, the weird fiction like Lovecraft or the 1930s, 40s Universal horror films I grew up watching on television, like all the Frankenstein series of Dracula, the Wolfman, and all that sort of stuff. I loved all that, but I didn't take magic, anything like that, seriously. I was always reading. And when I came across Wilson's book, The Occult, what was gripped me was that, not that it was about the occult, even though it was about that and all these fantastic people like Crowley and Gurdjieff and Madame Blavatsky and Rasputin and Nostradamus and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and all that, but he was writing about it in the context of this philosophy of consciousness. And I only found out later that he had a whole career earlier than that writing about existentialism and phenomenology. Which, I had read Sartre and Nietzsche. And I mean, one of the things I say in the book, when in my last year in high school, which is America, that's like a year, I don't know, 17 or 18, I had an English teacher who he taught me one thing and he taught the rest of the class the regular curriculum. So he handed me Sartre and Nietzsche and other books like that. So he recognized that I was interested in ideas and I was avid for it. And I got into the serious reading when the hippie girl I had a crush on gave me a copy of Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. And I was one of the million, adolescent American Hesse casualties. He had this posthumous bestsellerdom, Damien and Steppenwolf and all that. So I got very, all of that kind of, and that was another, like that opened up into Jung, because, Jung, some connection with Jung in there and Nietzsche and existentialism and all this other stuff. And so reading Wilson's The Occult, in it he talks about existence. He's talking, So I'm saying, why is Sartre turning up in a book about magic and stuff like? So, or making those connections, and that's what sold me on both him and, I guess, because his. I mean, I didn't know this at the time, but subsequently, because I got to know him well. I've written a book about him and all of that, and but his whole sort of focus is on what he calls this paradoxical character of freedom, and how freedom is what we want, and but when we have it, we take it for granted and get used to it, and all this kind of stuff. And so this was like a question of consciousness, and this is what really sold it for me.
Yeah, I had, I say, read Wilson from when I first discovered the occult. Say that back would have been early to mid 80s. But it was around the time, a couple of years after I'd started legalizedfreedom.com started podcasting, that I noticed there was a new little book on the shelf in the bookstore from Wilson's Super Consciousness, which was, as far as I know, the last thing that he published. And it was kind of like Wilson's philosophy of optimism just boiled down into, ironically enough, sort of more like a pocketbook. And I thought, do you know what? All this time, and I've never really had a forum for this sort of thing until now. So I'm going to approach him or his agent or publicist or whoever's working with him or for him. And just as I went to do that, set about doing that, I got the news that he'd passed away. So it was kind of like, oh, well, his work lives on. But yeah, I'd love to have, never mind, spoken with him, love to have met him. He just had that kind of, because I've watched, video interviews with him, and him being filmed at home and him giving talks and whatnot. And yeah, he was just something that somebody that, I don't know, he just connected with a lot of people in an almost populist way, if I can put it like, even though he was writing about these far out subjects and niche and esoteric and magic and mysticism and things that the mass of people have no real interest in, but in his own kind of realm, it was almost like, the people's philosopher or something. I can't really express it. It was just something unique
No,
about.
he was very approachable, and he was very, very readable. I mean, that was the thing. I mean, he was just imminently readable. I mean, somebody once said that he could make the phone book gripping. And I mean, he just ha and again, any kind of readable style that I have comes from reading and rereading his work. So I mean, there's just this wonderful. I hate readability. I hate this. I just hate that kind of phrasing. But there is his books. They're very, and they're inform you. You learn.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.